for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. In the biggest spy swap since the Cold War, 10 Russian agents in the U.S. were exchanged for 4 prisoners convicted of betraying Moscow to the West. One of the Marine Corps' most seasoned battlefield commanders will become head of U.S. Central Command in the Middle East and Central Asia. And Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu says he's ready for direct peace talks with the Palestinians. Here in the studio for the International Hour of our Friday News Roundup, Trudy Rubin of the Philadelphia Inquirer, James Kitfield of the National Journal Magazine, and Nancy Youssef of McClatchy Newspapers. We will take your calls throughout the hour. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
James Kitfield, 14 people were exchanged in the largest spy swap since the Cold War ended. Out of John le Carré, tell me what's going on.
Exactly. This is like a really blast from the Cold War past here. The U.S. rolled up this cell of 10 Russian agents that were deep sleepers. It's a very unusual thing. These were not people who were in the intelligence services. They were not people who were privy to classified information. They were sort of put in as deep sleepers to sort of infiltrate into the American elite through think tanks and ties to Wall Street, et cetera, to be able to sort of flesh out the picture of what's going on in America for Moscow. Now, no one told Moscow, I guess, that you could probably do this by a Google search. But so they put these 10 guys out here. We roll them up and actually got a swap for 4 former Russian intelligence people who had been in prison for spying for the United States. I think we probably got the better end of this deal.
What do you make of all this, Trudy?
Well, I mean, the first thing that struck me is how wimpy this is compared to the old days when Anatoly Sharansky walked across the Gleinecke Bridge from Potsdam in East Germany to West Berlin, the Bridge of Spies. You know, they get off a plane in Vienna, they get on another plane in Vienna, and the reason that the U.S. could let them go, besides irritating the FBI agents who had followed them for so long, it probably won't have any ramifications, is because they really didn't have anything. It's as if the KGB, now the FSB, and the Russian Foreign Intelligence Service could not let go. They had to maintain this kind of spy presence. But the other thing you have to say is that it does indicate the reset between Moscow and Washington, Obama and Medvedev, President Medvedev, because the thing was done without much fuss. And I just want to add one thing, that one of the Russians who was released, Mr. Sutyagin, was not a spy, was not in the intelligence services. He was at the USA and Canada Institute, and he was this nerdy guy who collected information on arms control. He made the mistake of selling unclassified information to what he thought was, I don't know, some kind of think tank in London, which the Russians say was a front for the CIA. It was dumb, but he has not admitted to being a spy except now to get let go. And it just shows you that I think that the Russian spy services have a real need to keep on going.
So what, Nancy Youssef, do you think that we'll ever really know the extent of what the Russians got out of this?
I don't think we ever will. This is the problem with trying to unveil what spies are doing. I was fascinated, and Trudy talked about the Russians not being able to let go. I wonder how much the FBI was able to let go. They started looking at these guys a decade ago on the heels of Robert Hansen, the FBI's agent who was also working as a spy and made $1.4 million over a period of several years. And you wonder, where is the balance between these sort of old Cold War tactics and issues and versus the counterterrorism and the world we live in today? It was such a contrast between the old threat and the current threat. It made me wonder, is this where the FBI should be placing its resources? A decade watching people who may have only been gathering things that, as James pointed out, could be found on a Google search.
But could we be underestimating the impact or the import of this whole thing?
Yeah, I mean, I actually think, you know, in counterintelligence, if you find a guy who you know is accepting money from the Russian intelligence service, you're bound to basically follow and see where that leads. Now, in this case, it did not lead to anything. I mean, they were not even charged with spying or passing classified information. They were charged with being part of a conspiracy, a Russian conspiracy, which is basically saying that they didn't get any the goods, but we still know they were working as agents for Russia. And I think if that is the case, you kind of have to keep your eye on them.
And the fact that the United States only held them for 10 days suggests that they didn't have rich information to share.
All right, let's move on to Cuba and its freeing of 52 political prisoners. They say they will release in the coming months. This comes after a meeting that included President Raul Castro and Cardinal Jaime Ortega. How come they've decided to do this, Trudy?
Well, for one thing, it seems that the Cubans are allowing the church to get more involved in mediation and giving the church a bigger role. Havana, a leading church figure, was a mediator along with the Spanish foreign minister. It may be a gesture to Obama. And also it comes at a very interesting time, which obviously the Cubans are aware of, where there is growing pressure inside Congress to lift the travel ban on Cuba and also to allow food exports. And this is coming from bipartisan direction. And so it may be that Raul Castro is realizing it's in his interest to open things up a little bit.
I agree with that. I mean, let's not forget, there was a big question when Fidel sort of stepped to the side and his brother came in, whether his brother was more of a technocrat. There were hopes that he would sort of relax things in a way that would allow some sort of a rapprochement or if at least a relaxing of U.S. restrictions and our isolation of Cuba. The Obama administration came in very early, and before it got entangled in a whole bunch of other crises, really had an idea to try to relax those restrictions in a way to see if their engagement strategy with former adversaries would work with Cuba. It was going to be a test case. It kind of got to the wayside because Afghanistan sucks so much oxygen out of the room. But there are still people senior in the Obama administration who thinks that we can get beyond where we are with Cuba, relax some of the restrictions on the money that can go back there, on visits by U.S. tourists, on visits first by family members of people in Cuba. So I think this is an important sign that Raul is saying, yeah, there is an opportunity with Obama, and it's probably belated, but I think it's definitely an outreach to the Obama administration saying, let's try to have warm relations.
I think one of the reasons you're hearing the hesitation about what this will mean is because there's still a contractor named Alan Gross who's being held in Cuba on charges of espionage, and that hasn't been resolved yet. And so you see this as a small step forward, I think, if a lot of people do, but the question becomes what happens next, and some of the instances that James has mentioned, and also with this case specifically of Alan Gross.
So would you expect that there might be some easing of the embargo, James?
I think that it will. I mean, I think you would look for a next step to be, I mean, Cuba is saying it will release all of its political prisoners if we will give them back five spies that we're holding who did not infiltrate U.S. intelligence agencies so much as infiltrated Cuban-American groups in Miami who are obviously very anti-Castro. So they want, if you see another spy swap like that or prisoner swap where they release political prisoners and we release those guys, then I think that would be a step towards closer and releasing some of the restrictions and closer relationships.
All right. And Nancy, we have a U.S. soldier charged with leaking Iraq war video. Tell us about that.
It's a really interesting case. It's a 22-year-old soldier named Bradley Manning who was a hacker, a proclaimed hacker, who claimed to have thousands and thousands of documents that he had obtained. And he one of the things that he is charged with getting his hands on was a video of an airstrike that happened in Baghdad in 2007. In Baghdad, it killed a Reuters journalist and his Iraqi aide, and it really caused a firestorm among journalists and in the Pentagon writ large about how they need to handle these situations. At what point do you make the decision whether to fire on someone? When you look at the video, it's clear to the naked eye that it's a cameraman, but in the fog of war, at the height of the violence, it wasn't so clear. And what I found fascinating were some of the comments that he made. He was caught, if you will, because he was making comments to another hacker who brought them forward. And he said he was capturing this to get to the truth, to get the truth out. He said that he had seen a bunch of Iraqis arrested and charged with being doing things against the government. And it turns out they were writing very thoughtful, critical pieces of Prime Minister Nour al-Maliki.
He also said he'd like to disrupt U.S. policy.
That's right. And I just think it comes at an interesting time because you have growing tensions between Washington and on the ground about the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And you saw this week an effort at the Pentagon by Secretary of Defense Robert Gates to quell leaks in a memo. And I think the frustration of war eventually comes out. And I think we're seeing this as an example of it now. That doesn't mean that he shouldn't have been charged, but I think this is a consequence of the frustration on the ground for those who've been in this war for now a decade.
What fascinates me is that he was able to do what he did. I mean, he downloaded 150,000 diplomatic cables, as well as a load of secret videos. And the way that he did it, U.S. military personnel cannot bring in thumb drives. The computers are locked. So he actually did it on disks. He smuggled the data disguised in as a music CD. He put the disks into a case for music by Lady Gaga, and he hummed the lyrics so people thought when he put the disks into the computer that he was listening to her music.
Is he going to be court-martialed, James?
Oh, not only court-martialed, he'll do prison time.
James Kitfield, he's senior correspondent for National Journal Magazine. When we come back, we'll talk about Iraq and Israel and take your calls. And we're back with the international portion of our Friday News Roundup this week with Nancy Youssef. She's Pentagon correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. James Kitfield is senior correspondent for National Journal Magazine. Trudy Rubin is foreign affairs columnist, editorial board member at the Philadelphia Inquirer. We do invite your calls, your questions on email, your comments on Facebook and Twitter. Let's talk about the violence in Iraq yesterday, which apparently was aimed at pilgrims taking part in a Shiite religious holiday, Nancy.
That's right. There were thousands and thousands of people traveling to Adamiyah, which is a Sunni neighborhood in northern Baghdad, to pay homage to the seventh Shia holy figure, call them, and that's where he's buried. And they were attacked. At least 28 people killed, 80 wounded, and it was, I think, clear to people an effort at resurrecting some of the sectarian violence. And it comes at a time we're now in month four of a political stalemate as the Iraqis try to determine what the outcome of the election will look like in this battle between the current Prime Minister Nour al-Maliki and Iyad Allawi, who has sold himself as a more secular alternative One had 91 seats, one had 89, and there's all these backroom negotiations going on. What I thought was interesting is that it didn't lead to an immediate question about the security forces. There were 200,000 Iraqi forces out on the streets. There was an acknowledgement that when these pilgrimages happen, there's only so much the security forces can do. It instead became a public questioning about the political situation, the politicians, the political setup, and whether it was serving them or hindering their...
But the violence had been on the decrease, James.
And even with, you know, it's hard for us to understand this in America, but even with this attack, the violence, if you compare it to 2007, is way, way down. And even 2008 and 2009, it's been down. But it does show you that a couple of things. Al-Qaeda in Iraq is still extant. It's still there. I talked to some generals or a general over there recently, and he said, you know, we're not going to decapitate them continually. The only way to basically win in terms of Al-Qaeda is for us to get out of the cities, for us to be in the background, because it's an irritant now. The Iraqi security forces are able to handle this. And this was Al-Qaeda's MO. Kill Shia is trying to cook off the sectarian violence that they saw with the bombing of the Golden Mosque back in 2007. It's not working, and that is the hopeful news here. It's not working, and you know the Iraqis show every sign of being very exhausted by this sort of sectarian and civil war. And we've also saw Vice President Biden in Iraq in the last week, and he's obviously, the American government is concerned that this stalemate has lasted as long as it has. I mean, these parliamentary coalitions are hard to form, as Biden said at the time. Even the Netherlands in their recent parliamentary elections took 4 months to form a government. But it's time, and the bad guys will try to take advantage of this vacuum of power.
But there was violence even in the green zone during the Vice President's visit, Trudy.
We are going to have all combat troops out by August. We're going to be down to 50,000 troops in Iraq, heading for zero. Now, there is a question as to whether there will be a new security agreement before our final troops, are withdrawn in the next year or so. And whether the Iraqis will be asking us to keep on some kind of advisors, because it's clear that their security forces, although improving, are still not up to this very complicated job of trying to keep sectarian violence down.
That's exactly right. And again, the people I talk to say, though, that post-2011 presence will be in the thousands, not in the tens of thousands, not in the six digits, but they're going to need U.S. capabilities in air power, in intelligence gathering, some very sophisticated stuff that they just don't have. They don't have much of an air force, logistics like that, but they'll be totally in the lead by then.
But I think we should point out that there wasn't the shock about the violence that there was in the past, because this was a pilgrimage. The Shia who went out there, you talked to them, they knew that they were putting their lives at stake when they did this, but they did it anyway. Mm-hmm. And I think this is really leading to more about a discussion about the politics versus the security forces. The security forces are showing progress, so the political situation is not.
One of the things that interested me is that the Shiite pilgrims were marching through what was once one of the most Al-Qaeda and Sunni radical anti-Shiite militia neighborhoods, Adamiya. They were heading for Shiite shrines in another neighborhood. But the fact that they, even for this year, I think was the first time, were rooted through this neighborhood, on the one hand, tells you how things have changed. Mm. On the other hand, that you can't control everything.
Well, and let's move on to Prime Minister Netanyahu's visit with President Obama this week. What was accomplished, Trudy?
A lot of theatrics. This was the reset visit. In March, relations were frosty. Vice President Biden had just been dissed when he went to Jerusalem, and even as he got off the plane, there was an announcement by Israeli officials of new settlement building, new housing, and he was furious. Obama was furious. Then Prime Minister Netanyahu came in March to the White House and was treated very frigidly. Relations between the two countries, close allies, had become tetchy. And so this was an attempt to show, hail fellow well-met, we are the closest of friends. You can't see daylight between us. Now, there was also an effort to give the impression that direct talks are going to restart between Israelis and Palestinians. Right now, there's indirect talks with somebody going back and forth between the two sides. However, the crucial element to me was that right now there is a partial settlement freeze going on, and it ends at the end of September. Prime Minister Netanyahu indicated that won't continue. President Obama the settlement freeze.
Okay.
And Obama won't continue. And Obama said that direct talks should start anyway, and he's hoping the climate will be good enough so that settlement freeze can go on. I think that's the real test here, because otherwise the talks are going to collapse almost as soon as they start, and you really can't make progress.
You know, and that's right. And for all the fence men, I couldn't help but wonder, Netanyahu could not escape his domestic politics, even in this effort to reach out to the United States. There's a reason that he has said that moratorium must exist. And part of it is to appease the right wing of his political bloc. So I can't help but wonder if what happened behind the scenes was a discussion that the direct talks will happen with the condition that you end the moratorium, that there'll be some link between those such that it gives Netanyahu the political leverage he needs to go to his base and say, yes, we're going to extend the moratorium, but we're also starting direct talks as well.
But also, weren't some of the restrictions on Gaza loosened even before the trip took place?
They were, and Gaza plays into this drama because basically Gaza convinced Israel that it was getting really dangerously isolated. You know, its closest ally in the Middle East, Turkey, is vociferously complaining about Israel policies, about the Israeli government, and the Obama administration is looking at midterm elections and knowing that if there is perceived rift with Israel, it doesn't play well with its democratic base. The Republicans will make hay about that. So both leaders decided it was time to get over this rough patch and try to sort of end relationships. But I think Nancy's exactly right. If they enter direct talks, and Netanyahu said it would probably be weak, so it leads you to believe there's some deal there. If they enter direct talks, that settlement freeze will have to be extended, because if you get into direct talks and then you start, you relax that settlement freeze, you will torpedo those talks and it'll be another chilly patch for U.S.-Israeli relations.
Does that indicate that the visit was a little more than just theatrics?
We don't know yet. I think at the minimum, we have to ask, how much could this week's events improve a year and a half of friction between the United States and Israel? It's a small step, but I think we're being careful and not overstating it, because this had gone on for so long. I mean, the reception that Netanyahu got in March was the most chilling I had ever seen. Obama kept him waiting while in the Roosevelt Room while he went to dinner with his wife and daughters. I mean, it was cameras were banned, and this time they were shaking hands before all the cameras. Is that enough to put things on the right track? We don't know yet.
There was also the issue of Iran, which was discussed. And I thought one of the most fascinating items of this meeting was an interview that Obama gave to Israeli television, which appeared, it ran last night, and in which he said that he expected that Israel would not undertake any attack on Iran without informing the United States. Now, clearly part of this visit was intended to show to the Iranians, after new sanctions at the UN, after Congress has passed new sanctions, that there's no daylight between the U.S. and Israel. But I thought it was so interesting that Obama had to say that on television, since there's been so much speculation that Israel might go and bomb on its own.
All right. And in the meantime, Nancy Youssef, what do we know about the three men arrested in Norway and Germany on suspicion of terrorism?
Well, it's a complicated case. They are three Norwegian residents, they're all Muslim. One is Chinese, one is an Uzbek, one is an Iraqi Kurd, and they were charged with working with Al Qaeda to plot attacks. This was in conjunction with arrests in Great Britain, and there was sort of a triangle of plotted attacks against the UK, against Manchester, England. So it turned into a quite a twisted web. But we don't know the details of it. And I think it raises questions about a lot of questions about where al-Qaeda is right now, that rather than sort of going to Pakistan and Afghanistan and having extensive contacts with people there, you have people of different nationalities, which we hadn't seen before, working from outside the Middle East, from outside the region, and only having periodic contacts with al-Qaeda leaders in Afghanistan and Pakistan.
That's exactly right. We've seen over the last 5 years, all these things look like sort of like lone wolf cells or local cells, but they all have ties back to the tribal regions of Pakistan, all three of these cells. And I think the U.S. indictment of the subway bombers from New York from last year sort of sparked this, because they knew that they were going to flush out other related cells who were tied to the same operative, al-Somali, who was killed last year by a CIA drone strike in the Pakistan tribal areas. He was in touch with all of these three cells. So when they sort of rolled up one, the intelligence services both in the United Kingdom and in Norway said, we got to roll up the other linked cells, because the word was spread very quickly that you're compromised.
So was Norway actually a target, or was it just chosen as a staging post?
The conviction or the arrest, sorry, of these men, there is no indication that targets had actually been decided on. In actual fact, the Norwegians wanted to delay those arrests, but AP was about to break a story, and so they had to go forward with them. They know they were plotting to bomb build, but they don't know what.
Trudy Rubin of the Philadelphia Inquirer, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. This whole Norway episode really does go to the question of how al-Qaeda is able to infiltrate, spread its wings wherever.
That's right. I mean, the connective thread in all this, that they were plotting to make portable bombs made of peroxide, that was their means of attack. And so you hear that and you wonder, have they decided they're not going to do these sort of large 9/11 like attacks, or are they incapable of doing it? And that's what we're trying to sort out. Is the admission now to do small attacks everywhere and sort of put people on edge with portable bombs, or is it that they can't plot attacks the way they once did?
But those portable bombs could do a heck of a lot of damage, Trudy.
Well, absolutely, and they can sow fear and they can do economic damage. But I think one of the fascinating things is that it does all trace back to al-Qaeda operatives in Pakistan. And that, again, comes back to the question of where is the problem. Now, I think that the administration wants to show that the links go back to the AFPAC region. But, of course, questions will arise about then why are we in Afghanistan. I think one also has to think that if southern and eastern Afghanistan fell into Taliban hands, the linkages between these groups are all very tight, and you might have the training of these people going on in southern Afghanistan rather than in Pakistan.
And on Afghanistan, General Petraeus sort of created a little controversy over rules of engagement, James. What is he saying, and how might that change?
Makes you wonder whether he's having some buyer's remorse about now. But, basically, this was one of the problems, the main problems, and it came out in that Rolling Stone interview that sort of cost General McChrystal his job. The frontline troops are very frustrated by the rules of engagement, which are very restrictive in terms of using indirect fire, because the chances of civilian casualties goes up precipitously when you use indirect fire or air power. So the troops on the ground tactically feel like their arms are tied behind their back. Yet the senior leadership knows that in a counterinsurgency, it's hearts and minds. It's about winning the population over to your side. And if you keep killing, large numbers of civilians, you will not be able to do that. So there is a tension there that was unavoidable when he did his confirmation hearings. He was going to be asked about that. He said he would relook it. Now, his number two, in General Rodriguez in Afghanistan, said he doesn't anticipate any major changes in the rules of engagement. Maybe Petraeus will have to tweak them at the edges to give a little more tactical leeway to troops under fire. But I don't expect you'll see a major change of rules of engagement, just because if you're running a counterinsurgency, you can't afford to alienate the population.
And what about the choice of Marine Corps General James Mattis to take over General Petraeus' post, Nancy?
You know, it's an interesting choice, for especially at this time. General Mattis, he's a Marine Corps. He's very popular among his Marines. He's also blunt, and he's known for a couple things of note. In San Diego in 2005, he said killing people was fun, and subsequently in Iraq, and when the incident happened in Haditha, Iraq, where 24 Iraqi civilians were killed, he was in charge of deciding who should be charged and who shouldn't. And of the 8 defendants, only one has faced charges in that. And you read the documents in terms of his decision to not charge them. He says, essentially, that war is ugly and ugly things happen in war. And he lets these guys go, saying that they did the best job that they could.
So why was he chosen?
Well, he is a strong figure. He's known as a counterinsurgency expert. Secretary Gates yesterday said that despite these comments, he's been reprimanded, he's grown in those 5 years, and that he is our go-to person to discuss. He's the next best thing we have on counterinsurgency. And frankly, there are very few people you can put in charge of General Petraeus.
He said, you know, it's a hell of a hoot. It's fun to shoot some people. I'll be right up front with you. I like brawling. You go into Afghanistan, you got guys who slap women around for 5 years because they didn't wear a veil. You know, guys like that ain't got no manhood left anyway, so it's a hell of a lot of fun to shoot them.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org. By the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. And by the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
A Single Man, the film about a closeted gay college professor grieving over the death of his significant other, is now out on DVD. On the next Fresh Air, we feature interviews with the star, Colin Firth, who was nominated for an Oscar for his performance, and fashion designer Tom Ford, who made his directing debut with the film. Join us.
Welcome back. It's time for your emails, your phone calls, your posts on Facebook, and your tweets. Trudy Rubin is here. She's with the Philadelphia Inquirer. James Kitfield of the National Journal Magazine. Nancy Youssef of McClatchy Newspapers. Here's our first email from Kathleen in Athens, Ohio, and apparently there are numerous ones reflecting the same view. She says, Bradley Manning is a hero. He released footage of Iraqi people being killed by U.S. soldiers. He released footage that should have been covered by our mainstream media. What did our military and government from Vietnam, did not show Americans pictures or footage of is what's going on in Iraq. And our media has gone along with the agenda. Nancy?
You know, I hear in Kathleen a frustration about not knowing what's really happening in Iraq and Afghanistan and a hunger to get something other than what we're hearing from official channels. I think it's interesting that she compared it to Vietnam. Some people have compared the soldier to Daniel Ellsberg and the release of the Pentagon Papers. I think it's a frustration, a widespread frustration amongst us, among soldiers, that you hear one thing in the official channels about what's going on and you see something very different. And we're seeing that now. You know, July, we're in the ninth day of July, 16 U.S. troops have been killed so far. Last month it was 60. Those are Iraq numbers. And yet when you go to the Pentagon, the line is the situation's no longer deteriorating.
It's an interesting case. I actually, you know, was reminded of Abu Ghraib and the leak of those pictures when I saw that helicopter video. And I actually had no heartburn with that. As a journalist, you want to see that stuff. And I think the Pentagon sets itself up by releasing these very sanitized, you know, bombs through a window to kill an al-Qaeda guy, but not wanting to show you the ones when you basically got it wrong. And so I think it's fair game. I will say that this case is more serious, though. He released thousands and thousands of classified State Department cables, also to WikiLeaks, and we don't know when those are going to show up and what they say, but that could cause you serious problems if your most classified State Department cables are suddenly public. It could hurt your relationship with allies. It could cause any amounts of trouble. So I think the military knows that this is a serious case of leaking classified information.
Judy.
I agree on that point. When I first heard about the film, especially if there was a journalist killed, I thought, all right, this person was acting from idealistic principles. Then when I read further and saw that there were all these cables released, I thought perhaps he's just a bored soldier and he's just doing this for a game. It's hard to tell, but I do know that you can't just systematically leak diplomatic cables. And I will say, in defense of journalists, I think journalists have done an awful lot of good work on the ground, including McClatchy, in unearthing murder of civilians in some notorious cases. So I think you have to look more deeply at what he was doing.
All right. And here's a follow-up, and I think you've just answered that. It's from Matt. He says, how come releasing war policy is called a Pentagon leak and no problem, but releasing video that shows the military represents us around the world sometimes shoots first and asks questions later is considered treason and the whistleblower is put in prison? Nancy?
Because it's a huge area of gray. You know, the Pentagon wants to control the message. They want to control what people see of the war, what the war looks like.
But is there anything, Matt goes on to say, is there anything to protect soldiers with access to such videos from coming forward? They want to tell the truth as they see it.
No, there are no protections. You are not allowed to decide. Every soldier cannot be given the carte blanche to make that decision. It has to be made at higher levels. And the gut instinct at higher levels is to classify stuff and to manage the news. So there's this constant tension there. But no, you do not give the soldiers carte blanche to make that decision.
All right. Let's go first to Dennis, Massachusetts. Dana, you're on the air. Good morning.
Hello?
Yes, Dana, you're on the air.
Oh, okay, I didn't quite. Okay, thank you. Well, you know, this issue about rules of engagement being too strict, according to the troops, well, maybe that should call into question the legitimacy, the moral and legal legitimacy of America's invading and occupying countries like Iraq and Afghanistan. Maybe we have no, because we knew that civilians would definitely be at stake simply because we're waging war there. So I don't know why, if you'll pardon the expression, National Pentagon Radio never discusses at root the legitimacy of American involvement in these countries.
Dane, I think we have had many, many discussions on that. And, of course, NPR has many reporters that have brought you the accurate news that they are allowed to bring and no more?
I think you always have to keep in mind a comparative figure. If you look at the numbers, the civilians killed by U.S. collateral damage, the number is dwarfed by the number of civilians that are killed by the Taliban. And I've spent time in Afghanistan, as have my colleagues, and you know when you go out in the boonies, you go out, you meet with shoras, most do not want the Taliban back. So, yes, the U.S. is in a bind, but as it happens, civilian collateral damage has gone down sharply since these rules of engagement, while Taliban killing of civilians has gone up.
All right, to Annie in Manchester, New Hampshire. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. My question is about a BBC report about 4 evenings ago that Britain is planning to recall its troops from southern Afghanistan because of heavy casualties, loss of life, and that they'd be replaced by ours. Now, I haven't heard any more. Can you expound on this? And where in southern Afghanistan? I think I heard the area Singh or Sinj.
Nancy?
It is true, and U.S. troops will be going into southern Helmand province, which has been one of the deadliest areas in Afghanistan for British troops in proportion to the number of troops there. And Annie's exactly right. The political pressure in Britain to get out is tremendous. We're beginning to see rising U.S. troop deaths here, but in Britain, their troop deaths have been going up steadily in the last year as they've been in one of the deadliest and most dangerous parts of Afghanistan in the south.
All right, to Mindy in Alexandria, Virginia. Pardon me, you're on the air.
Hello. I wanted to make a comment. I'm a soldier, and I don't speak for the military, but this is my personal view. There's a perception problem that the rules of engagement have actually changed recently, and I saw this when I was in Iraq last year. When we moved out of the cities, the soldiers started complaining about rules of engagement as if they had changed and that it was preventing them from doing their mission. It's rare that the rules of engagement actually do change, and there is plenty of leeway to defend yourself if you're following military doctrine and your commander's intent.
James.
Well, it's an interesting point. I mean, the rules of engagement definitely did change with McChrystal. He announced that. And so in that case, she's right that they don't change very often. And the rules of engagements are very classified. So you don't hear a lot when they're changed. But they sent a signal because there was a huge amount of frustration on President Karzai's part that he had to take the brunt of the political backlash whenever there are these civilian casualties. So they did change. They were more restrictive. We don't know exactly how restrictive, but clearly this tension between frontline troops and senior leaders who have a strategic perspective on a counterinsurgency campaign is inevitable. And right here is something that Petraeus now has in his lap firmly.
One of the things that has come out on this issue is that often mid-level commanders are interpreting these rules of engagement more strictly than perhaps they were intended. And so when soldiers on the ground want to call in, say, helicopter support if they're under fire, the commander back at base is saying no when perhaps there's sufficient leeway to do so. And I think that's what Petraeus is going to be looking at, easing up on the mid-level restriction,
all right,
if necessary.
To Palm Beach Gardens, Florida. Good morning, Jake. You're on the air.
Jake?
Yes, go right ahead, sir.
Yes, I want to speak about the Israel situation and Netanyahu being pressured to talk to the Palestinians, where the Hamas and the Palestinian Authority are dedicated and have in their covenants to destroy Israel. Why is the Obama administration pressuring Israel to speak rather than pressuring the Palestinians to recognize Israel as the Jewish state and then make peace?
James.
A little clarification. Hamas is pledged to Israel's destruction. The Palestinian Authority long ago recognized Israel, recognized its right to exist. The language of as a Jewish state is very controversial to them because it just, you can imagine, they've been fighting over the same bit of land for a very long time. So they're resisting saying that. But, you know, the comment of the Palestinian Authority, Mr. Abbas, who leads the Palestinian Authority, is, we recognize Israel's right to exist. It can call itself whatever kind of state it wants to. But so I think there has to be a distinction has to be made between Hamas and the Palestinian Authority.
But how do you bring Hamas into these discussions?
If you can figure that out, please call the State Department because they would love to know.
I'll do my best, James. Go ahead.
I think the bottom line with Hamas has always been to convince the population that a better deal lies with the Palestinian Authority, that the Palestinian Authority is making some headway on the issues of basic concern to Palestinians. The reason that Hamas took over in the West Bank and it didn't win a majority is because the other Palestinian Authority, the more moderate voice, were kept out of the give back of Gaza. Gaza was basically given back unilaterally by Israel, which empowered Hamas, which said, see, our violence got it back. If it had been given back in negotiations with the Palestinian Authority on the West Bank, they would have been strengthened. Hamas never would have won elections. So you have to ease conditions, and that will weaken Hamas.
All right, to San Antonio, Texas. Good morning, John. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you. Yes, Diane, I've got a question for your guests. You know, we talk about the U.S. being the honest broke in the Middle East, but it just seems to me like, can we ever be that? Because back a few months ago when the U.S. administration was upset with the Israelis for their behavior, I think justifiably so, suddenly a couple months later, the pressure comes out from the AIPAC and the other Jewish lobbies in the U.S., and Obama gets worried about the next elections, and suddenly they reverse their position, and it's all hugs and kisses, and everything's fine. That's horrible. We need to treat other countries objectively and fairly, and I just don't see that we ever do that with the Israelis. They always get what they want. Is there ever going to be a time when we can stand up as a country and make these decisions and act independently and objectively vis-a-vis the U.S. and Israeli relationship?
All right, and before you hear your answers, let me just remind you, you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Nancy.
You know, John makes his comments at a very interesting time because the Israelis would charge that the Obama administration has been tougher on them than any previous administration as of late. So it's an interesting time to make that observation. The reality is there is no better broker out there than the United States. This is the only option on the table in terms of having someone to negotiate this. And so I think you are starting to see a shift in position in the United States, a very slight one. We saw it a little bit with General Petraeus when he testified about the United States' role in the region, its contribution to the anger that's seen on the Arab street. So you're starting to see, a wider discussion about this very issue.
All right. Here's an email from Sharon. She says, how do the prosecutors and police who've been working on exposing the Russian spies feel about the swap? James.
Well, it didn't really get to a prosecution. How the FBI, who are in charge of counterintelligence, feel about these guys being let go, we really don't know yet. Although I suspect that, Obama met with Medvedev. It's a reset relationship. He didn't want this to blow up, but they thought they might lose some of these guys, and they convinced the president to roll them up and to arrest them, make a big deal about it. And the fact that they didn't really pass along any damaging classified information probably gets them a relief, especially since we get four spies back who you suspect, since they were former Russian intelligence guys, actually did pass along interesting information.
So are you saying that the president knew the FBI was going to do this while he was meeting with Medvedev?
Well, I don't know if he knew right when he was meeting, but he certainly would have to sign off on this. Absolutely.
I would assume he signed off on it, right. But the timing is my question. Did he know and did Medvedev know? Had they reached that agreement while they met?
It has not come out that they actually knew why they were meeting.
Yeah,
but again, you know, they're trying to sort of get this reset going. So it's an awkward moment to have a big spy scandal.
All right. And finally, Trudy, let me ask you about this. The UN Security Council today condemned a deadly attack on a South Korean warship that killed 46 sailors, pointed a finger toward North Korea, but did not directly blame that communist nation.
Yes, and this is so interesting because the South Koreans had done a very thorough investigation, and it is very clear that the North Koreans blew up that ship with mini submarines. And the reason that that was not straightforwardly noted, although the South Korean study was mentioned, is because China does not want to offend North Korea. I think China is going to have to reconsider its policy. North Korea is going through a transition. Kim Jong-il is dying. His untested 26-year-old son is taking over. And China cannot deal with the possibility that that regime could start collapsing. And so I think it doesn't have a forward-looking policy, and it's going to be caught in a dangerous situation, as are we all, if North Korea.
Well, and that's my question. What about the U.S.? What position does it take?
Well, we'd rather had a very strong statement saying North Korea did this and they should be sanctioned for it. But China's not going to go along with that. They have a veto in the Security Council. And so we got this sort of watered down, but still significant, I think, condemnation of what happened.
James Kitfield of National Journal Magazine, Trudy Rubin of the Philadelphia Inquirer, Nancy Youssef of McClatchy Newspapers. Have a great weekend, everybody. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Andrew Chadwick. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.